Now, on March of that year, you held simultaneous conventions of Congressional Union and the Woman's Party, and they voted to unite into one organization.
What?
There was a, you held a national convention in March.
Are you talking about?
In 1917 in Washington, of the Congressional Union and the National Woman's Party. And the main action was that they united officially into one organization.
Yes, well, it wasn't exactly a convention. That was just a group, I think, of the leaders.
And
you see, we'd formed the Women's Party of the members of the Congressional Union in the suffrage states and called it the Women's Party for political reasons. Then we were confronted with two, that we had all the women in the non-suffrage states who were Congressional Union members calling themselves Congressional Union. And the same women in the suffrage states called themselves the Women's Party. And I remember the person who did most of this business was Mrs. Belmont, because she liked the name National Women's Party, and she was, of course, very influential in our board because she was giving us so much financial help and was such a, and also so much help in every possible way. So I don't know whether people thought the Women's Party name was so wonderful, but we knew we had to have the same name. Our members in Nevada, for instance, who are our members at this national headquarters in Washington, even though they call themselves Women's Party members, were on the same real relationship to the national board as the women, we'll say, in Kentucky, who were in the non-suffrage states. So I remember our meeting together, and I think Ann Martin and a few people have been elected out of that meeting nationally. And probably our national board. I don't know if there was a real convention. Did it say it was a big convention? It was just an agreement to change our name and make the name National Women's Party for all women, all Congressional Union members, wherever they were.
It's called the Union Convention. Union with a little U. In the write-up here.
Say anything about it particularly?
Oh, it has a long article on it, that the essence of which is that this will unite the two organizations, and it will culminate in picketing of the White House, and it also culminated in women trying to get in to see the president, who on March 4th had just taken his oath of office for his second term. And he refused to see them.
And who led that delegation, did it say?
Let's see. There were nearly 1,000 women. That'll be in our next issue here on March 10th. It says here, even the women's personal cards with the resolutions to be presented were refused transmission to the president.
Didn't say who. Yeah. In the photographs, did it say who?
The leaders of the delegation were Miss Ann Martin of Nevada, Mrs. William Kent of California, Mrs. Daryl Weeble of North Dakota, and that's W.
Daryl who?
Daryl Weeble, W-E-I-B-L-E, of North Dakota.
I don't remember her.
Miss Mary Patterson of Ohio, Eleanor Barker of Indiana, Mrs. J.A.H. Hopkins of New Jersey.
Oh, yes, she's one of the very important women.
And Mrs. Florence Byard Hills of Delaware,
I see what we did. Mrs. Hillis was in the non-suffrage states, and just as an example, Mrs. Hopkins was non-suffrage state, and Mrs. Kent was in the suffrage state, and Miss Ann Martin was. And as I remember very, 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 very vividly, so I remember we met and we agreed and said we'd go forth now as one group. And
it was a drenching rain.
Was it? And I remember the only point that I think maybe there was some, this was March 7th, 1917, was it? Just before we went in the war?
Yeah, it was just before we went in the war.
We went in the war April 17th.
March 4th, 1917.
All right. But this is the only thing that was a difficulty, was who would be the board and who would be the leaders of this group.
Oh, yes.
And I think Miss Martin, perhaps, but Mabel would know much more about all this than I. I think that Miss Martin and some of the people felt she'd been elected at this meeting in Chicago, and she should be the new chairman. Anyway, I remember talking to her about it, and it either had to be Miss Martin as the chairman or I as the chairman, because I was of one group and she was the other, you see. And so I told Miss Martin that I wish she would become the chairman and take it over. I'd done it, I thought, maybe long enough. And that I would become a vice chairman and work with her. And she said no, she would rather have me continue, and guess she would be vice chairman. I don't know if that's how we settled it now, but I think we did.
I'm trying to see. Oh, officers were elected unanimously at the morning session. Chairman Alice Paul, Vice Chairman Ann Martin.
Yes, that's what
Secretary Mabel Vernon.
That's what I've been thinking about.
And then Lucy Burns and Mrs. Belmont and Mrs. Brannon were all on the executive board.
Yes.
Mrs. Gilson Gardner, Mrs. Robert Baker, Mrs. William Kemp, Miss Maud Younger.
And see, none of those were such young women.
And Doris Stevens, Florence Byard Hillies, Donald Hooker, Mrs. J.A.H. Hopkins, and Mrs. Lawrence Lewis. All those now were on the new executive board.
Well, that was a magnificent group of women. I want to point out the exception, Doris Stevens. None of them could possibly be called young.
All right. Good.
But I was much younger than Ann Martin, but we didn't have any real friction. I always felt that she really didn't think it was quite right that she was replaced.
Mm.
But it was done without any apparent friction.
Yeah. And yet she did not want you. She wanted you to be the head.
I don't think
said.
She. I really think she didn't. Is what
no.
I mean. But anyway, when I asked her to take it, she said, and I said that it would be I would be just as happy to be vice chairman, maybe happier. And anyway, she wouldn't. Whether she thought the responsibility was too great, financial responsibility, or the having to come to Washington to vote every minute of the time, I don't know what it was, but she didn't. So from that time, we were the National Woman's Party, you see. Now, we had been incorporated. I see, we were incorporated in 1918, the next year.
Oh.
Never been incorporated.
Well, this was an enormous demonstration with women from nearly every state. Each one carried their state banner and so forth. Let me know if you
but
want to
But that delegation to the president is to say who took the delegation. Did you read me? Miss Martin, I guess.
Yes, it mentions her name first.
I wonder if that's the time we walked around the White House all day long.
Yes.
Oh, well, that is.
Think so.
That's one of the biggest we ever got up. And I know that was the day that was drenching rain.
Yes. And around, because it was Inauguration Day. Now, all during this time, there was no problem of violence or outward crowd hostility. I guess that happened when
We were never arrested until the war had been declared, and we kept on. And as I told you, when we got this round robin, headed by Mrs. Blatch, urging us, our own women, you see, began to revolt against us because we wanted to go on with the picketing. And they wanted us to stop the picketing. And the whole National American was then solidly against us because they wanted to go right into the war.
Yeah.
And wanted to push Jeanette Rankin and everybody else into the war.
And then you did get into the war.
Then we got in the war April 7th.
And on April 14th, you may have forgotten this. I thought it was sort of interesting. The first war losses were mostly women. It was a munition factory explosion in Chester, Pennsylvania. 118 were killed, and with more expected to die at the
But I remember that the time that I was called up by this Major Sylvester, and he said that they had decided that they could not permit the picketing any longer in view of the war and so on, and that if that he wanted to warn us that if anybody did go out again on the picket line, it would be their duty to arrest us. And we said, well, we think it's our duty to continue to go out, so we did. And then from that time on, while they were arresting the women, of course, that sort of inspired the crowds, I think, to great excitement.
Yes, this was when you carried that famous Russian banner, when your first arrests.
Well, that was later
came
on.
Came in the mob. That was in June.
Yes, it was later on.
June 23rd.
We began to be arrested pretty soon, I think. If you can find that account of the first arrests were made, I think you'll find there this Lavinia Dock I've been telling you about.
I see, that's
so. I think in this first group that were ever arrested was Catherine Morrie, one of our very wonderful Massachusetts women.
Where are you going to eat?
So we'd be arrested. Well, that was really a big highlight.
But that was, didn't you get that after they had already arrested you some?
No.
No,
he sent a formal, and I received, and I remember it very well. And then we didn't know exactly what to do, and various women, among them, Catherine Morrie, I can remember, said, all right, then we have to have people willing to be arrested, and I will come down and be one. So she came down from Boston. She was one. And Lavinia Dock, it's my recollection, was the second one.
All right, I'll get a list.
I'm sure you'll find them there.
Yeah, it should be right here, because here's the story.
That's after it got going. This wasn't the first arrest at all, but you are now. You didn't have any of that excitement and violence or anything.
No.
I might have been on the first group, but I don't think I was.
Catherine Morrie.
Morrie, that's one. She was.
And Lavinia Dock.
Lavinia Dock, yes, she was. Have you any other? Is that people who crossed clean enough?
Which was the turning point? The arrest?
When people were willing to continue with that picketing, it was a big division in the woman movement, you see, when they sent this round robin from so many influential women headed by Mrs. Blatch to demand that we stop the picketing. And the White House had the chief of police call us up. So it was really a big turning point. But that's when our militancy really began. Just going off and standing there with our beautiful banners wasn't anything very militant.
No.
But this really was, I would say, the beginning of the militancy. And whose names, have you any other names? I remember, I was sure I was right, Morrie and Lavinia Dock. They must record that people went out that first time and were arrested.
Well, there is a good chronology of all the arrests in the July 21st issue.
We were first arrested, we had all to right. put it in. Because of my goodness. I want to tell you one thing, may I?
Yes.
A meeting was being held over in Pennsylvania somewhere. And one of our well-known women was chief speaker there. And in the midst of the meeting, the press called up and said, so many women have been arrested in Washington. And the people were dumbfounded at this meeting that we were being arrested. And, it was just
Lucy Burns and I, and I is Catherine Morrie because she's writing this article.
Sure. Because she, I think, went into all this with the greatest thoroughness when she wrote this book.
Maybe she has some dates listed.
Looks like that on Sunday, June 24th, was when the police major called you and warned you.
Sunday, anyway. You got the day was Sunday.
Yeah, on June 24th. And on Monday, quite a few women went out and were arrested. But the Friday before that, two women had been arrested, Miss Burns and Miss Morrie. But their case had not been called. And I don't know whether it ever was or not, because I'm only reading this. As of July 21st, it had not been called. But those who were arrested...
And you gave me last night the names of about six people who were arrested, and I know you had somebody named Neil that I never heard of.
Yeah.
And you had Maud Jameson and Virginia Arnold and Mabel Vernon and Miss Lavinia Dock and Miss Maury.
Right. But you think the real red letter day, Alice, is the day of the very first arrests? Yes. Or the day the first women went to prison?
No, I think the first arrest, because if you were arrested, if you decided to be arrested, you were to be willing to be arrested, you change your policy, you see.
Well, that was June 22nd, and then June 27th was the day of the first sentencing.
Yeah, so I think the day of the first arrest would be the turning point.
Okay.
Excuse me a minute, I'm going to get my check from Mrs. Stalin.
All right.
Well, no, I think that's very important that we got through that period.
Yes. the first...
And then she gave a little summary that you could use, that there were altogether what number arrested and what number in prison.
Oh, yes, that's from the... I'll plug this into the record while you write your check for your housekeeper. Carolyn Katzenstein, Katzenstein.
I told you in the very beginning of that book, she tells about how we held our first open air meeting in Philadelphia, you know.
Yes.
In the opening call.
And that's it, right at the beginning. On page 206, she sums up the prison. Yes. On page 206, she says, of the 168, 21, wait a minute, that more than 500 were arrested during the agitation over the whole campaign. And of these, 168 served prison terms, some of them several terms. The title of the book is Lifting the Curtain, The State and National Woman Suffrage Campaigns in Pennsylvania as I Saw Them. And copyright 1955, Dorrance and Company, Dorrance.
Well, what is it, Bill Weston?
That's a big number of women, 500.
It's really quite amazing. Because you see, it wasn't at all of... Today it's sort of commonplace to be arrested, but it was certainly extremely unusual at that time.
Well, especially for women who were very cultured and, as you were pointing out, who absolutely would never think of even picketing in any other circumstance.
The first women who did it, it gave it such a good start because the women of such prestige, for instance, Miss Maury, was of a very distinguished family up in Massachusetts. And there's a statue to one of her ancestors as you go out to Brooklyn. I used to go up and stay with her mother in Brookline. Her mother was our state chairman. Every day we would drive home from our little headquarters down on what is that great park you always speak in Boston. Boston Common, wasn't it? Right there on the Boston Common, we would drive home to the Maury House, and there we always passed the statue of her great-grandfather, we'll say.
Oh.
It was a very well-known family. So when these people kind of gave it a standing, it wasn't quite so hard for the others to follow, I think.
Yeah. Well, I notice here on this court case, the United States versus Mrs. Julia Hurlbut of New Jersey, Mrs. J.A.H. Hopkins of New Jersey, Mrs. Minnie D. Abbott of New Jersey, Mrs. B.R. Kincaid of California, Mrs. Paul Reinau, R.E.Y.N.E.A.U. of Michigan, Miss Ann Martin of Nevada, Mrs. Amelia Hines Walker of Maryland, Mrs. Florence Byard Hillis of Delaware, Miss Janet Fotheringham, F-O-T-H-E-R-I-N-G-H-A-M of New York, Mrs. Gilson Gardner of Washington, D.C., Miss Doris Stevens of Nebraska,
Mrs. John Winters of Brannan, Mrs. John Winters Brannan of New York, Miss Mary H. Ingham, I-N-G-H-A-M, of Pennsylvania.
She was very distinguished woman. Every one of these people was very well known.
Mrs. John Rogers, Jr. of New York.
That's the one I'm telling you was such a trump from the very beginning. She was Stimson's sister-in-law.
Who, Mrs. Rogers?
Yes.
Or
Secretary of War Stimson.
Oh, that's right, yeah. I remember now. And Miss Eleanor Calnan, C-A-L-N-A-N, of Massachusetts. And Mrs. Louise P. Mayo of Massachusetts, M-A-Y-O.
Is that the end?
That's the end of those in that court, listed in that
yes, there was a very
court case.
And my recollection is that Dudley Field Malone, who was a very close friend and associate, you know, of Mr. Nixon, I mean Mr. Wilson,
mm-hmm.
had campaigned with him and been given by him the position of collector of the Port of New York. And he was then married to one of the big political, democratic political families in New York. I've forgotten what her name was. He was. And he had showed every sign of being quite infatuated by Doris Stevens. I guess he was. You said 26, 16. I'm sure he got those women out, is all I'm trying to say.
Out of jail and pardoned.
Got them pardoned, because he knew Wilson so well.
Oh.
Miss Paul, the clothes were...
That was the pardon by the president on July 19th, unconditionally pardoned 16 women who had been sentenced on a technical charge to serve 60 days in the government workhouse at Occoquan. Everyone seemed to... feel that the pardon was what we would today call a cop-out by Wilson. And there's a good write-up here on the trial on page 7.
Anyway, she, Mrs. Hopkins,
of the suffragist,
I think took a very good position. She said they hadn't done anything they shouldn't have done and they didn't want to be pardoned by the government for something that they considered there was right and proper that they'd done, and so she wouldn't accept the pardon all by herself.
And the very next day she went out and picketed.
Yes.
and I suppose was arrested?
No, she wasn't arrested.
Oh, there was a time right after that pardon when they didn't arrest anyone.
That was Mrs.
For a short while, wasn't there?
That was just the only one who wasn't arrested I know of was Mrs. Hopkins when she went out.
Hmm.
And nothing would induce them to arrest her because it brought up the whole question of whether Wilson did have the right to pardon them and so on, you see.
Oh, yes. Oh, I see. Oh, which was a legal question they didn't care to get into.
They certainly didn't want to, because her position was quite right, that you can't pardon a person for something that you haven't done, you're not in a position to be giving a pardon. So I thought it was very gallant what she did.
Hmm.
And then we went on with our regular picketing, and we were regularly arrested, as far as I can recall.
Well, things got livelier and livelier, it seems, as the summer went on, and the suffrage carries comments of the police encouraging attacks of hoodlums, and one of them in August, there's a note that you were knocked down 3 times. And a sailor dragged you clear across the sidewalk trying to tear off your suffrage sash for a souvenir. And there were no police around.
Does it say that in there?
Mm-hmm.
That's another question. I don't know where this man got all these things.
That's August 15th.
And I said, but I don't think that ever could. I don't remember a single thing about it ever being thrown down. I said, I don't see how I could be thrown down and not remember.
Don't you remember being kind of frightened by all these crowds around you?
No. I don't remember. Maybe I was.
Mm-hmm.
I was more sensitive, I think, not to any of these crowds and that sort of thing, but to the general feeling of the whole country that you were scum of the earth and all that.
Oh.
Charlie?
What's out here is that most of your banners were not inflammatory, that you were quoting President Wilson's own words.
Yes.
Back to him in
yes.
most of them, and I think we've kind of missed that point here.
Of course, we were trying to, we really, you know, weren't addressing President Wilson. We were addressing the people of the country.
Yeah.
To try to get those words over to the country.
Well, you had another big one on Bastille Day and then on through August. And in the meantime, in September, there was a so-called investigation of Occoquan Workhouse.
What's that?
Yeah. Which...
I still remember
this was the one written up in the suffrage. It's just a whitewash. Dudley Field Malone was ready to be your counsel for it because in the meantime he had resigned in protest.
Yes, but who was conducting this investigation?
And the investigation was called by the district commissioners. Was that your district government? Yeah, got it written down here. Yeah, district commissioners. And
I think Dudley Field
there Malone, was a hearing.
And was Dudley
Field, which was secret.
Was Dudley Field Malone conducting the investigation for us, representing us?
He was representing the women who had been in there, and some of the men, too. And then he refused. He was all prepared, but when he got up there, the suffragists say that the hearing was secret, and Malone refused to take part in a secret hearing. He wanted a public hearing.
Oh, yes, and he couldn't get it.
And he couldn't get it. And what happened was that the Board of Charities gave a whitewashed report, and Superintendent Whitaker was reinstated. And by that time, it was October 2nd. And a lot of other women were in. There was a period there then where they began to not send people to the work, not send suffragists to the workhouse, but kept them in the prison, in the jail, I mean.
Yes, I thought in the beginning they went to the jail and only afterwards to Occoquan.
Well, it seemed to go back and forth. During this investigation, they didn't send
it them. It seemed to me that I was in prison toward the beginning, and I know I was in and I was in with Mary Windsor and Lucy Branham, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in the district jail.
Yes, this says on October 20th you were arrested.
October?
October 20th.
No, but I think I was arrested before that. And this first time, when was the time when I went in the psychopathic ward? I think that was the first time.
Well, I missed it if it was.
Because this man, Mr. Gallagher, told me all about that.
Yeah.
And all about how this newspaper man who was close to the president came down to interview me.
Yes.
And how I was put in the psychopathic ward.
Yeah.
And the head of St. Elizabeth came to interview me. He must have gotten that all from the suffragists. You haven't come across
that? Well,
that's
that's in Jail for Freedom, and yes, I've come across it.
And you haven't come across it here in the suffragists?
But not yet. But you were in, you had been sentenced to 7 months in jail.
No, but that wasn't the first time.
And you were put in the district jail, and then I think you were transferred from there to...
Occoquan. No, to the district psychopathic. That's the second time.
But that was when you had a hunger strike.
Yes, but that wasn't the first time.
Yeah.
The first time, as I say, I remember, we were in the very beginning of our going to prison. And Mrs. Lewis, I think, had gone up to see Mrs. Dora Hazard in Syracuse, who was the wife of the that great man up there in Syracuse, who had the Eastman Kodak Company and so on, all those things, I think. Well, she was on our board, our advisory board or something, or New York City board or something.
Mm-hmm.
And and Mrs. Lewis went up to see if she would advance the money. This was the time that we were put out of our old headquarters. You know, I told you about how the man came and said they couldn't have people going to prison.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know. Did he really put you out?
Yes, I told you all that.
Oh, no, I knew. You said they were unhappy. I didn't realize that he really put you out of your headquarters.
Well, maybe we could have resisted, but we didn't. He came in, and I remember so vividly, and I was in bed. I guess I was just lying down to rest or something, and he came in to sat down, very courteous lawyer, I presume he was, and said that the estate he was representing would like to request us to leave as soon as we possibly could, was embarrassing to them to have people going to prison from this building and connected with this whole affair. So I said, all right, how much time would they give us, and so on, and we would go and immediately try to find another place and go as soon as we could. So we were really just put out. And then we had the problem of finding a place, and we couldn't find a place right away. So Mr. Gash, Herman Gash, who probably came across him many times, he was a real estate man who was also a very good personal friend, and he found a place just across the street on Lafayette Square, but just a little tiny apartment, more or less. So we transferred ourselves across there and put things in storage, I guess, somewhere. I don't know how what we did with our possessions. Maybe we left them in the Cameron House till we could really find a place. And then we did find that the owners of this building that I think is now occupied by the Brookings Institute, just right across from the Cameron House, that was for rent. Whoever had been there was empty, I believe. And I think this Mr. Gash, this real estate man, found it for us. And they said they would rent it to us if we could pay $1,000 a month and 1 year in advance or something like that. And just almost that very day we got that ultimatum, I was sentenced to prison. And the only two I can remember being in with me were Mary Windsor, because she made a daily prayer for all the prisoners, and Lucy Branham, because she was in the cell next to me, and she was always telling me how to eat, saying, now shut your eyes tight and just take a bite, and then you'll have it down. This was when the food was so that we really couldn't look at it. Wow. And I never shall forget her. She was such a courageous girl. And she was instructing me so much how in the world we could ever swallow the slice of bread we're giving us. Well, but I don't remember anybody else. But I remember Mr. Gash coming and saying, well, Mrs. Lewis has returned from, she was our treasurer. And I would love in these things to get some honor paid to all these wonderful women. So Mrs. Lewis said she would go up and try to do this terrible thing of raising this sum of money. And she went up to see this Mrs. Hazard. So Mr. Gash came down and asked if he could see me as a client of his. And when you say client, it was that we were real estate, not a law client or whatever you are. So he came in and came up to my little row of cells and was assigned to a seat. And I think I went out and sat down beside him. And he said, well, Mrs. Lewis has come back with the 8,000 we had to raise. I think it was 8,000 she raised, in addition to what we already had. So he said, now I can make out the check and we'll take over the building. And that's when we moved into our present our last headquarters.
And that was
just about where the Brookings, you know where the Brookings is?
On Massachusetts Avenue?
No, right down on Lafayette Square.
Oh.
About 2 doors from the White House.
Oh, I see. Well, Brookings has now moved, so...
Have they? I didn't know that. It used to be the William Randolph Hearst residence.
Oh.
It was owned by his estate.
Oh, I see.
I guess, or by somebody who had inherited from him. And they asked this enormous rent. And we raised it. And paid it. So by the time I came out, we could go into our own headquarters where we stayed until the campaign was over. Well, that was fairly early in this campaign.
Yeah, and it was after a crowd had tried to attack your other house too. And could you tell us anything about that? The night that the mob surged across Lafayette Square and.
Yes, but did you find that in here?
It's mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's it say there? I would.
Alice, it'll take me so long to find it.
Oh, it will?
Yeah. But it mentioned that Let's see, there was a pistol shot, or some kind of a shot that went in the windows.
That was very early in the period you've been going over.
Yeah. And it's...
It was very early.
But it sounded like it was fairly scary.
Well, I can remember that there was an actual invasion of our headquarters, the only time it ever happened, and that they did fire shots, some shots of which went, I think, through the windows there. I don't know if it was anything more than that.
Yeah. It was shortly after the police chief had issued his ultimatum to you. It was just within a little while after that.
Yes, I thought it was a little way after that.
Yeah.
I remember when very well, one of our members who had been chairman of one of our committees, and these people were all assembling around there, and lots of noise and so on, and without a word, I saw her get up and go out the door, and she never came back. And it was a very alarming thing, and people didn't want to be in any way associated, so we're now, this is the limit, I'm not going to be here any longer. Mm. But I don't think any great violence was done to the building.
Did you have any...
People were very terrified, that was all.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was your hunger strike. By November 24th, you had gone 30 days without food. There's a note about that. And there's a lot in the Suffragist about the leader being imprisoned. You managed to smuggle out notes somewhere.
I guess in this time I was in the psychopathic ward, wasn't I?
It doesn't say that yet, but you were smuggling out notes. And I think it was from...
Well, I don't remember anything about smuggling out notes.
You don't?
No.
Well, they printed one from you, and you were... A lot of times your notes were just on things like getting ready... telling people what to do to get ready for the December meetings and convention or something. In other words, business of the party. And then suddenly everybody was released. This time they were released on a writ of habeas corpus in a U.S. District Court in Virginia. And this was by action of Dudley Field Malone, because he alleged that when you had been transferred to Occoquan, this was illegal.
I wasn't to Occoquan, I was a psychopathic ward.
That a lot of the prisoners, I guess, had been taken to Occoquan. The immigrant Polish girl, Rose Winslow.
Yes.
And she was in jail with you.
Yes. She was also in the psychopathic ward with me. Mm. The only person who was transferred to the psychopathic ward. But this was toward the end of this whole campaign. I think if I look at Mrs. Irwin's book, I can probably find this easily.
Put in this, we should mention in the record about this long quotation from you that Doris Stevens got in her book, and it's on page 200, starts on page 210, and it's on your experience in prison and in the psychopathic ward, and ends on page 228. And it includes the visit from the journalist, David
Lawrence. I certainly owed a lot to that Dr. White, because it's been so very easy for him to have given an adverse decision, and I might still at this moment be in the St. Elizabeth.
That's right. That's a chilling thought.
And all this I owe to Dr. White.
And we might point out he's the one who first interviewed you, the alienist.
Yes, but I know he was the head of St. Elizabeth, you see.
Yes.
And I know that he gave an absolute absolute statement, because he came up to see us later in the headquarters when I was there. And we got to know him fairly well.
Oh, really?
And he just completely, he said, would have nothing to do with it. Wouldn't in any way consent to have me transferred to St. Elizabeth. And he had the final say as the head of St. Elizabeth. So I've always felt the greatest sense of indebtedness to him. Because I don't think anybody could. And so I'm afraid with many women, many women over the country. And I was all the time you were reading this, I was thinking of a woman who called me up 2 days ago, I think. I guess the day before Thanksgiving was. And from Washington. And she said just about everything I said. She said she was the wife of a judge in the Court of Appeals in Illinois. And he had gotten a divorce from her and married somebody else. And the home that they had, she felt she had built up equally with him, which they'd lived for maybe 15 or 20 years. And suddenly she was put out, and this other woman was put in. And she tried to, all the ordinary ways of protesting, getting a lawyer, and no lawyer would take her case because he wouldn't take a case against the judge of the Court of Appeals. It would be a difficult thing for him ever to survive as a lawyer, perhaps, in Illinois. And she'd come down to Washington about, I guess maybe 2 years ago, while I was there in Washington. And I was called up. Do you want to hear this or not? Maybe I'm diverting you too much. I'll say it very fast. Well, she can anyway. Not that I think you can do anything about it, but it's just so typical of what's happening to thousands of women, is what I mean. Well, she, I was called up by the Annapolis Hotel, and they said somebody's arrived here from Chicago, and she wants very much to see you. And I said, all right, please send her up. And it was in the quite early morning, and I said, I'll have breakfast for her, and invite her as my guest. So she came up, and then she told me this tale, and that she'd come to Washington because she could get no justice out in Illinois. And her husband, when he divorced her, had given a very tiny little alimony on which she couldn't survive. And she was so harassed by being constantly threatened that they would put her in an insane asylum if she made any trouble for this lawyer, for this judge. And so she thought she'd come to ask for help. So I said, all right, first of all, I'd give her a little money, as she said she had none at all, and just enough to pay her bus fare down to Washington, she said. So I did a very tiny little sum. And then I said we would entertain her for a time at the headquarters, not charge her anything, and she could have her room and her meals there while she was looking around and seeing what she could do in Washington. So she wanted to go to her congressman and her senator. So I called up the congressman and Senator Percy's office and made arrangements for her to go and see both of those offices and be received. And otherwise, I guess she never could have gotten in, but she did get in very easily in the congressman's office. And I think Senator Percy's office, she didn't, because they said she'd already been there and there was nothing they could do for her, something like that. Well, this all happened in this previous time. And we did everything, absolutely everything that I could think of to do for a person to... But we didn't have much. Couldn't hold her down. She was fluttering here and fluttering there and going hither and on. She went over to the Supreme Court and wanted to speak to the Chief Justice and things like that. And she went down to the Attorney General's office and wanted to speak to the Attorney General. And she was each time being turned away as perhaps out of her mind. And so finally, one day, after about a week or 10 days, something like that, she just announced she was going back to Illinois because her case was coming up. And I said, I don't advise you to go back, because if you get into this court, they may put you in an institution. But she went anyway. And gradually you forget these people. So I'd even forgotten her name when she called me up just now. And she said, now I'm back in Washington. And I went up to the headquarters, and the person who was there, whose name was Mrs. Chitty, wouldn't have anything to do with me, and just shut me out of the house. And so she said, I found a little colored maid there, and she told me your telephone number, and so I went to the telephone to call you on the long distance. And she said, I've found a place where I rent a little tiny room and out in the suburbs, and from some name, some sound like a Polish name, she gave it to me, long, long, involved, a lot of continents thrown together. And she said, they just want to get some little money, so they let me come in for a week. But I have to pay this rent or I can't be even here. Well, so she said, now I want to come right up to see you. And I said, well, I don't know if there's a single thing that I can do from here, but I'm going to, if you give me your number and so on, I'm going to see what I can do. And I will try to. But you just come up against it, this helplessness of people, men and women, men as well as women, I'm sure, who are being sent into these institutions. You know, even our Mrs. Hillis, this wonderful Mrs. Hillis,
yeah,
died at some kind of an institution.
Oh, really?
And her daughter, probably it was money, I don't know what else, her daughter, one only child was a daughter, her husband had died, and her daughter married a man, a Catholic.
Your position as leader of the National Woman's Party, that if you had gone into St. Elizabeth Insane Asylum, that you would have stayed there? It seems to me that surely they could have gone.
If you say, well, this lady, unfortunately, she was very good in a way, but she was mentally unbalanced. And people are apt to believe it, I'm afraid. Mm. I know that there was absolutely nothing the matter with Mrs. Hillis, and I think the cruelty of a daughter doing a thing like this, probably under the influence of her husband, and maybe under the influence of the church, which was trying to get possession of her fortune. We don't know what motive would have animated them, but you wouldn't think that it was possible, when you know the record and the title of Mrs. Hillis, that she could die in this institution.
Yeah.
So I could have died in this institution and be there this moment.
Well,
so I think it was heaven protecting me, I guess.
Should we go on to some of the things that were going on outside the prison at that time?
Like, go ahead, whatever you want.
All right. You did have speakers going around all over the country.
Yes.
And something like, wasn't there a train?
Yes, we had two trains. First was a suffrage special, and then there was a prison special. Suffrage special was a group of women. I think we took one car on a train, and we said, like Mabel Vernon, I don't think she did this, but the same way she organized for Sarah, we had people in every state where the suffrage special would stop, get up a big meeting, and you'll find all that, of course, in suffragists.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just to spread another way of doing something different, so as to perhaps get a little publicity on it.
And you had a very dramatic story to tell at this time.
And then we had then came the next one, which was a prison special, which we took the women who had been in prison. They went in their prison costumes, and they got out, and they spoke at these great meetings in their prison costumes. It was all, you know, general propaganda to hold the Democrats up to a bad light and so on.
Yeah. Well, when you look at the chronology, you can jump to the conclusion that your picketing was very effective, because just right after your picketing got started, Mr. J.A.H. Hopkins tells about talking with President Wilson. And Wilson asks him what he thinks he should do about the suffragists, and finally asks him if he thinks that...
it was his wife, you know, who wouldn't accept a pardon.
Yes, I remember. Well...
My, what a wonderful woman.
Wilson was considering making suffrage a war measure at that time. This was July 18th.
Which year?
Of 1917. And he asked Hopkins if he could find out about
what would happen if he decided to put in suffrage as a war measure, and would he please find out how it would be received by both the Senate and the House. And then, right during this time, the House Judiciary Committee voted that only war emergency measures should be considered. But the Senate, which had voted out the bill on May 15th, finally reported it out with a favorable report on September 15th. In the meantime, the state of Maine lost its suffrage referendum, something like 2-1. But before that, on July 19th, Wilson unconditionally pardoned the 16 women. And by the way, that attack on the headquarters came on August 14th. I just noticed that day. Now, back on the Hill, on September 22nd, the House finally created a suffrage committee. And that happened on September 22nd from Chairman Pou, how did you pronounce that?
Pou,
of the Rules Committee. And this was interesting because Wilson had finally asked Chairman Pou to consider the President's request to establish a suffrage committee. He had done that just a few weeks earlier, after your picketing started. But then on October 6th, the war session adjourned, and that was also when you were first arrested, and it adjourned without suffrage being considered. And on October 25th, Ohio loses a suffrage referendum. And women continue to be arrested. On November 12th, there were 41 arrested. At least it's talked about in the November 12th issue. But that may not be the exact date. And then right after November 24th, I'm not sure of the exact date here, is when all suffrage prisoners were released, and that was on that writ of habeas corpus. But it looked like that when Congress closed, it looked pretty optimistic then, and the suffrage magazine Sound Optimistic.
That was the end of 17.
And that was the end of 17, and then you had your meeting in December, I guess, your big meeting of the National Woman's Party.
That he would support the amendment. He went up to the Senate, you know, and made this.
Yeah, that was later. That was in your 1919 session.
Constant insistence through the picketing were the two real methods that we used.
One was constantly opposing the Democrats, you say?
Well, the policy of opposing all Democratic candidates.
Yeah.
In all the suffrage states, I mean, using the votes of women to win it for us. We couldn't have made it a political issue by opposing it in these other states, which weren't even for it.
Yeah.
And the second, I think perhaps that was the more important thing that we used, and it's because we had a constant supply of support from behind at home, in the Senate and the House.
Yeah.
Because, as I said, I don't think anyone but Laura ever voted against this or ever opposed this. I don't remember anyone else from the suffrage states.
When Maine lost the suffrage in September...
So many of these lost it. You see, Pennsylvania lost it, New Jersey lost it. We were having so many of these go against this.
Well, in the suffrage... magazine of September 15th, Carrie Chapman Catt says, in response to the Maine loss, that all suffrage forces of the nation will unite in the near future and concentrate in Washington for a drive on the federal amendment.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, when did she say that?
Now, that was in September of 1917, after Maine lost, but before the New York referendum had happened.
But that's simply amazing that she finally did come out for it.
I think England, at that point, England had equal suffrage. Sometime in the recent past, England had voted for recent suffrage, for women's suffrage. And Russia had it.
I know, but the fact
Canada
that
Canada was about to have it.
Mrs. Cat had opposed it so long, I didn't remember that she ever did come out. That was 1917, really, in the midst of the war.
Well, I wonder if she really did.
Well, you say she said so.
She said that in the near future that they would do this.
I think at that time they were all working in the defense, and maybe they thought that they could make some kind of a bargain about that.
Yeah.
My goodness, as you recall all this, I realized what a very great resistance Mr. Wilson took up to something he said he believed in.
Yeah.
Almost impossible to believe.
I wonder what he did with things that he opposed.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, on Jeanette Rankin, performed another service. She got the House to pass a resolution appointing a committee of seven to investigate Occoquan just at the end of the session. So I guess that investigation then came up. Comes
and then,
up in
the you know, the only member of Congress that came out actually came to the ever to visit any prison to see what was happening was the father of Lindbergh. Did you know that?
Oh, I thought, well, Jeanette Rankin visited it a couple of times.
I don't think so.
According to the suffragist.
Because I asked her about the other day, and she said, no, I never went out to the...
Oh, really? Well, there's a profile of her given in the suffragist, along in the fall of 1917, one of those issues, and it mentions in there that she had visited the women, either in jail or in Occoquan.
Well, then, of course, if it's in the suffragist, I'm sure it's true, but she'd only forgotten it the way I forgot being turned down. Because she told me that. She said she was sorry she never went, but she never did.
Mm.
But I do remember Lindbergh, because we didn't know the famous son then, but he was a member of Congress, and he was the only one that I ever recall that went out to really see what was going on in the prison when all this fuss was being made.
Yes, I read about his visit, and I couldn't figure out where... I was thinking that it was his son, but
no.
This was the father who was in Congress.
Yes.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, I do have an announcement to make, that on October 25th, Wilson publicly endorsed suffrage as a war measure.
When did he do that, too? In a speech to Congress or what?
No, this was, I don't know how he did it, but it could not have been in a speech to Congress because Congress had adjourned its war session. I don't think there was anything going on.
Well, I would consider you made it mark that as one of the high points for Consuela.
That's another one, yes. You remember that great day?
No, I don't remember it at all.
Yeah.
We knew that he was coming along, but I don't recall any one day when something happened.
Well, I guess there were a lot of indications by that time that he was on the verge of coming out.
But which particular day, the time that he made it public to the world was when he went up to the Senate and made this appeal.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And of course, that was almost the end. That was almost the end of the campaign. And that was a great speech. We've had a mimeograph, and all through our present campaign, we've been circulating it to show what one president did for equality for women, to try to encourage the others.
page 6 of the suffragist, Saturday, November 3rd.
He made the speech before the Senate?
He did not. He made it. You were in prison, incommunicado, at that time. That's why you weren't in on it.
No, but I mean the speech. I wasn't in prison when he made that speech, though.
President Wilson was speaking to a delegation of New York women who asked him to encourage the voters of New York State. Oh, this isn't the amendment. He endorsed suffrage for the women of this nation as a war measure. He stated clearly that the war burdening the country cannot excuse the leaders of any party in neglecting the question women are pressing upon them. And he says, quote, "The world has witnessed the slow political reconstruction, and men have generally been obliged to be satisfied with the slowness of the process. But I believe that this war is going to so quicken the convictions and the consciousness of mankind with regard to political questions that the speed of reconstruction will be greatly increased. And I believe that just because we are quickened by the questions of this war, we ought to be quickened to give this question of woman suffrage our immediate consideration." Now, he knew, it goes on to point out that he knew that legislation in New York State lies outside of his power. He knew, too, that millions of women and men who demand that he pass the federal amendment next session were listening to him. So he set out the case for national suffrage like a political leader who sees the side he must take in a national issue, while at the same time he bade the Godspeed to the New York election required by the occasion. His statement assures suffragists of action from the administration that has kept women disfranchised. Already there have been clear indices that he planned at last to act. The reporting out of the long-buried amendment in the Senate at the end of the war session and the creation of the suffrage committee in the House proved that the pressure of women's agitation had forced the Democratic leader to turn from his obstinate stand against national suffrage. And then it ends, and it says, "It is no longer safe to oppose federal suffrage. The president comes all the way to endorse it. President Wilson has learned his lesson. The National Woman's Party will hold him now to action in the December session of Congress."
Well, then in December session, he probably made this appeal.
And that probably is. The particular volume of The Suffragist has a lot of firsthand notes from women in prison, and we can encourage people who use your manuscript to look it up here. I noticed here some prison notes of Rose Winslow, and here's some by Mrs. Mary A. Nolan describing that night of terror, which was November 14th.
Oh, she'd be a good person. I told you, remember, that when I went to Florida, about age, when I was talking about age, too.
Oh, yes.
At the oldest picket,
mm-hmm,
was the one who came up and volunteered. And that Mrs. Nolan.
And that was she. And
we used to have so many pictures when we got out the photographs, the oldest and the youngest picket.
Somebody in National Woman's Party know Mr. Joseph, how do you pronounce his name, Tumulty, who was private secretary to Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, what about him?
Well, apparently he was, he told members of the National Woman's Party in December that, "Of course I am with you," and promised to speak to the president about the federal amendment. Do you know anything about that?
No, but I know he was the secretary.
Well,
and Tumulty was the personal lawyer for all Mrs. Emma Guffey Miller and her family, you know.
Oh.
Senator Guffey of Pennsylvania, of course, a very prominent Democrat. And
I see.
That's Tumulty the senior. When he left, when Wilson went out, he started a law office. And then we inherited the son, so we have Tumulty the son now as our...
Oh, you do?
As our attorney.
Well, apparently someone was able to arrange a deputation to him.
86.
Oh,
Well, what year?
See, what year?
Oh.
It's too bad they don't put a better calendar, isn't it? A better, put up the date of the year at the top of each page or something.
Yeah.
Well, let me see if I can find the year. Passed the suffrage amendment, but what year it is, I have the date, and it was September.
Okay.
22nd.
I think
that. If you look at September 26th, it was.
All right. Well, the amendment passed the House January 10th, 1918, so maybe that was in September of 1918. At any rate.
But in
you
the
have
suffragist,
the Senate,
could you see the year you were on in September 20th? The
president's speech there? Well, here it is. Here's his speech on page 7 of the October 12th, 1918.
Well, I think you ought to mark that for another highlight.
All right.